Good morning. The House State Affairs Committee will come to order. It is March 11, 2010. With us this morning, we have Representative Peterson on the left, Representative Max Grunberg. We have Representative Johnson, Representative Wilson is excused, although she's going to be a little bit late. She has an excuse. And Vice Chair and Representative Paul Seaton is excused. And Representative Gatto is here. So we are ready to do some business. We have a pretty full agenda. I'd like, if possible, to move most of these bills we have before us today out of committee. First one we're going to hear is HB 251, which you heard previously, priority of towing lanes. Then you'll be hearing suicide prevention council meetings, electronic and telephone cooperative voting, violent crimes emergency compensation, and HB 348 personnel board membership. So we have a full agenda. I'd like to get started as soon as we can. Welcome everybody in the audience. And Representative Ramirez, I thought I saw you. Would you come forward, please? Good morning, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing our piece of legislation. It's always nice to see all five of you plus the two that are missing.
It'd be nice to see them too. Would you just kind of give us a quick review of what we did last time, and then proceed and see what we can do with this morning?
Roger that, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 251, we heard were our friends in the towing industry, who are often called out by emergency services to tow a vehicle. There's a charge that's incurred. The vehicle goes to the impound yard, and then powers greater than they are able to get it out of the impound yard, and they go unpaid. And this would simply put them before the lien holder, so that we take care of the little guy before we take care of the bank.
Any questions so far?
Mm-hmm. Do you want a motion?
Do you move the bill?
Yeah.
Anybody online who would like to testify on this?
Chairman, I think you closed testimony.
I beg your pardon?
I thought you
closed. Did we close public testimony? Well, even so, anybody online like to testify on it? Okay, I'll get it. Anybody in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Representative Peterson, do you have a comment?
No.
Okay. Representative Grunberg?
Representative Gatto. Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's a bill about priorities, and if indeed I have a deal with Representative Peterson, I sell him my car, and he says, "Well, I'll give you $200 a month for 5 years." I fully expect that if there is any extra liens on it, they would be secondary to me, because that was the original lien. That any new thing that comes up, unless I am the government, or which, you know, IRS or somebody that takes priority. That's the only question I have, because he might still owe me $2,000. The car gets towed to a lot. It's $100 for towing. All right. But it's $100 a day, and it sits there for 2 months. I have essentially extinguished all of my legitimate ownership of the vehicle, all of it. And instead, it went to a towing company. That's my fear of what will happen to an ordinary guy who is first in line, and then somebody by this law can say, "I can displace you." That's what I'm worried about.
Representative Ramirez?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it has been a privilege to serve with you for almost 6 years now. And I appreciate the anticipations that you have of how bills can go awry, and I admire your skill for that. In this case with vehicles, I believe that, and I don't have any statistics to support this, but I believe that overwhelmingly that vehicles are owned by banks and by you know, oftentimes predatory lenders, and rarely does a transaction occur that includes time payments between two individuals. It's just a great rarity, I think, in that apologize, Mr. Chairman. And I'll bring donuts to the whole committee if you insist.
Okay. Is that on the record?
Fruit bowl.
So I just, through Mr. Chairman and Representative Gatto, I just think that it's, such an insignificant fraction of transactions that exist between two individuals where the tow charge comes between the person to whom the funds are owed. And in almost all of the cases, I think we would hear from tow truck operators is that it's banks that are behaving like the 800-pound gorilla on the block and are rolling right over the position of the working man.
Representative Gatto?
Yeah, thank you again, Mr. Chair. So, and I understand the position that what I'm talking about is legitimate but minor relative to the concept of trying to protect an ordinary business owner who did something in good faith, and we don't want, you know, do we favor the business owner over the corporation? I understand that, but I wanted to make the point and see what the response would be, because of, like you said, proportionally. I mean, all our responses are proportional. So if this is an incidental amount of loss to a corporation, but a major loss to an ordinary business owner who's just got his neck above water and that's all, then I understand. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've talked to Representative Amherst's staff, Jane, on this. We do have some issues to deal with. The bill goes to Judiciary next, and I'm prepared to move the bill out with the understanding that we'll deal with these issues in Judiciary. Because, frankly, the law, I'm going to go a little farther than Representative Gatto, and I think we need to be careful of the rights of financial institutions, too. We have to look at how to deal with this. Part of the problem is in another section of Title 28. It gives it a towing company only a, quote, possessory lien, and that requires them to keep possession of it to protect themselves. And it may be we need to rework that a bit, because otherwise what Representative Gatto says is absolutely correct, and the person who really gets hurt is the little guy who owns the car, because they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They can't pay the towing, and the towing company has to keep the car, and that escalates the cost up. And we need to deal with this, but this isn't the committee to deal with that. And if, with the assurance of the chair of Judiciary, we'll deal with it in Judiciary, I'm prepared to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I see that Representative Grunberg is as helpful on state affairs as he is on the Judiciary Committee.
Yes, he is. And I think he's helpful to the point he'd like to make a motion. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, there's other recourses available to people. Small claims with the in this state, depending on whether you like it or not, the permanent fund dividend can be garnished as through a judicial process. I think small claims is $50-$75. So if someone were to lose out in some of these small incidentals, there is recourse. And the chances are that even though it's a small person with the permanent fund dividend and the kinds of things that we have in this state, that there's other recourses. So I don't know how big an issue this really is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any comment to that?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
In my part of town where there are a lot of poor people, they sometimes get pulled over for a taillight out or something, and then they find they don't have insurance, and then it goes to the towing lot, and then it sits there because the person doesn't have the money to get it out. This is part, and I've been concerned about this for a long time. I'm glad we have this subject in front of us, but I don't want to deal with it today. I think we need to look at it in your committee.
All right, thank you very much. If no other comments, Representative Grunberg, I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move the bill and attach fiscal notes with individual recommendations.
Okay. Without objection, the bill moves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. At ease while we do the paperwork. Next, we'll be hearing. We're now going to take up HB 349 involving the Suicide Prevention Council. Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us why we should consider this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Fairclough. What we have before us is House Bill 349 relating to the Suicide Prevention Council. Last year, if you remember, we carried House Bill 123, which was a reworking of the council as well as extending the Suicide Prevention Council since it was set to sunset. By adding additional members to the council, they have since found that it's a little more difficult, since we do live in a large state, for them to reach a quorum for their meetings. So what 349 does is gives them the option to establish a quorum and vote by either in person or by means of teleconference if necessary.
Okay, any questions for Ms. Kahneman? Okay, anybody online wants to testify on this? Okay, anybody in the audience would like to testify on this? Representative Fairclough, if you'd like to make any comments? Okay, I'm going to close public testimony. Do you have any comments from the committee?
Do you want a motion?
If not, I'll entertain a motion. Yes.
Just one thing.
Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm inclined to hold this bill because I do so enjoy having Crystal before this committee because she is one of my favorite staff members, and I just wanted to put that on the record. She does a great job, and with that, I will certainly not stand in the way of this.
Would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move HB 349. With individual recommendations and any attached or zero physical notes that might be there.
Thank you very much. With that, HB 349 moves from committee. We'll take it at ease while we do more paperwork. Please come back to order at 8:20. Next up on our agenda today is, let's find the number here, HB 336. Six, we have a CS we need to adopt for discussion. Would somebody like to make a motion to adopt the CS?
I move that we adopt the CS, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Without objection, we'll be working off the CS, which is /R. And this is an act relating to electronic voting procedures for electric and telephone cooperatives and providing for an effective date. Ms. Manley, would you like to introduce the bill, please?
For the record, my name is Nancy Manley, staff to Representative Bob Lynn. HB 336 puts in statute the ability for telephone or electric cooperatives to allow members to vote by electronic transmission as specified by the co-op bylaws. This bill was filed at the urging of co-ops around the state. Currently, co-op members may only vote in person or via the postal service. This method is outdated and could be having a negated impact on member participation in elections and other important matters. Passing this legislation would permit electronic transmission, but only if approved by each co-op bylaws. Cooperatives choose whether they want to partake or not. This bill does not make electronic transmission voting mandatory. Matanuska Telephone Association members have already voted to adopt a bylaw allowing electronic transmission voting. All they and other co-ops need is for the legislature to amend the statute to allow these co-ops to do so.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Manley? Yeah, let's hear from, yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like, is there a definition of electronic voting any place in statute?
Okay. Mr. Steyer, would you like to respond to that, please, and introduce yourself?
Yes. For the record, my name is Phil Steyer. I am the Director of Government Relations and Corporate Communications for Chugach Electric, a member-owned electric cooperative whose members have also already voted to amend the Chugach bylaws to allow electronic voting. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the term electronic transmission arguably is broad and can be subject to different definitions by different people. And that is why the phrase, as specified by the cooperative, was added to the draft of the bill that resulted in what's before you now. And the intention there is to allow each cooperative to set up voting procedures which work for that organization. In the case of Chugach, what we have in mind is to allow members to vote via the internet, but not, for instance, to send me a text message on the day of the annual meeting saying, Phil, here's who I want to vote for. So as specified by the cooperative is in there intentionally to allow people to take that broad definition of electronic transmission and narrow it down and create procedures that work for that organization.
Reverend Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that would include fax as well?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it could include fax, I believe, if an organization wanted to do it. In the case of Chugach, you know, this is an incremental process, amend state law first, amend the bylaws, actually. We did those two out of order. And then, if it's permissible, sit down with potential vendors of this service and talk through what they could provide and how they could do it, and think clearly about what you want to do for your organization. So while faxing would be a form of electronic transmission, in the case of my own organization, I'm not sure it's a form we would or would not put into our election procedures. What we have in mind specifically for Chugach is the ability for members to vote via the Internet.
Mr. Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And can you kind of walk me through the security that is intended to be in place on this electronic voting, and how you can adhere to the philosophy of this country of one man, one vote, or one person, one vote?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I can only do that conceptually and theoretically, because, again, I can't be specific because Chugach has not adopted any specific procedures as yet. But I will tell you, the vendors who have come to us have, obviously, this is fairly commonly done in the lower 48 for other cooperative-type organizations, is my understanding. There are organizations that make their living doing this for co-ops in the lower 48. At least a couple of those came and talked to management folks at Chugach last year in meetings that took place while I was out of town. So I don't know specifically what they do. I have talked to a couple of other co-ops in the lower 48 that have instituted this. And at least for the Internet voting, the system is each member is mailed an election packet. The election packet contains a member number, which is how we currently keep track of our members. So the member number is signed by the cooperative, and then there's a unique control number that goes with that voting packet. A person can go on the Internet, enter their member number, enter that control number, and cast an electronic ballot. And the control number can only be used once. So once having been used, can't be used again. Now, in the case of our, and again, I don't know if that's the system that a prospective vendor to Chugach would propose to use or not. That's the one I'm aware of from conversations with a couple of organizations in the lower 48. Our current system allows, Chugach allows in-person voting and voting by mail. In the case of voting by mail, we mail you a packet, and it contains a return envelope on which we put your member number, and it has your name and address, and then there's a signature line. And members cast their ballot, sign the envelope, and return it, and those signatures are compared against signatures we have on file. So that's the current security system versus the prospective one, at least used by a couple of organizations.
Anybody got them?
Did you have a follow-up?
Well, I beg your pardon.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to be on the record of I support this legislation. I think it's important that people participate. The easier we can make it, the better. I am concerned about security. I will continue to look at this and monitor it. As long as I am a member of the co-op, as a member, I will monitor it. It is important to me that we adhere to the philosophy in this country and not fall prey to some of the things that have happened in other countries where, and maybe other cities that we can talk about in other states, that we don't want deceased people voting. We don't want people voting twice. We don't want people gathering up out of post office boxes a bunch of ballots and voting. So the security is going to be very important to me and something I'm going to watch. I support this legislation, the concept, but I want to be on record that the security is a concern, and encourage all the co-ops out there when they're drafting these bylaws to put that in the forefront. It's important to get votes, but it's more important to get qualified member votes than it is anything else. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm done.
And I share the same concerns. In fact, you know, I vote electronically. That you, Mr. Steyer, cannot identify me as voting for candidate A versus candidate B. And is that built in? you'll never know whom I vote for, or...
Mr. Chair, that is a very legitimate concern. And again, it's not yet built in because we've not yet selected a vendor and determined procedures, but that is clearly one of the concerns that needs to be addressed as we're moving through this. And if I may, to Representative Johnson's comments, we wholeheartedly, you know, agree that security is important. I happen to have been in charge of the Chugach election for most of the last, you know, 24 years, and my goal every year is to have a process that can survive any challenge. And that's been, you know, foremost in developing our procedures for our current election, voting methodologies, and that would need to be foremost in adopting electronic voting. Frankly, my point on this to my, you know, fellow cooperatives and to members of this body is this, you know, no organization, my own included, should pursue electronic voting unless they can assure themselves they can conduct a secure election. So we do share that concern.
Thank you. Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steyer, I think you mentioned that a person voting electronically must supply both a member number and a control number.
Through the chair, in the example, Representative Gatto, that I gave, that's how the couple of co-ops in the lower 48 that do this do it.
And if I can continue, those two are linked so that having one but not the other would result in no vote?
Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question because I only know a little bit about how others do it. I don't know the detail behind that methodology, but that would be logical.
And, Mr. Chair, furthermore, the paper ballot is pretty simple. You get it in the mail. Then you lose it or you decide, got it in the mail. I remember getting it, so they go online. Is there some way to retrieve both their member number and their control number and go ahead and vote? I'm like Representative Johnson, I'm looking for how to scam the system because that's what people do. If you want to get your guy in there, you figure out how to beat the system and register 460 votes in favor of your guy. And those techies know how to do this. You can hire somebody and they'll charge you $10 a vote and get you 460 votes. So my concern is the security locks on electronic voting, boy, they've got to be like a vault. And I hope you can pull that off, but I have, you know, we've lost our identities. Not every 10th person has identity theft, and look at the way we protect ourselves. Maybe not well enough. So that's my concern.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I echo your concern. In the beginning of these cooperatives, my own included, which began in 1948, the way people voted was in person. And then, probably about the 1980s, this newfangled idea came along, let's let people vote by mail as an alternative. I went to work for Chugach in 1987. In the spring of 1987, during our election time, and the spring of 1987 was the first year we had conducted a mail election. And I was kind of on the periphery of that. And then there were some personnel changes, and the next year I wound up in charge of the election. And I sat down, one of the things I did for that election was wrote election procedures. And I came up with about three dozen steps to ensure the security, in part, to secure the security of that election process. And that was for a vote by mail. And really the process entailed thinking through, as you have suggested, how might somebody try and scam the system? And writing down procedures trying to prevent that. And that's worked well for us for the last 20 years. And now we're on the verge of taking another step because technology has evolved and we feel this is a comfortable step to take. But I would argue we should be equally diligent if we decide to take this step in sitting down and doing the same thing for this new technology, this internet voting, if that's what we do, and have procedures that are just as well thought out as the mail voting procedures were. But I can't answer every question about the what-ifs and what might happen yet, but I would hope, certainly before we would conduct this process, that we would know those answers and be comfortable with it.
Representative Gatto?
Thank you. What if you get both a paper ballot and an electronic ballot returned?
It's the same as asking, through the chair, Representative Gatto, it would be the same as asking me, what happens if the machine that stuffs a ballot in the envelope accidentally stuffs in two? That certainly can happen today. And there are lots of things that can happen that might cause, you know, you to inadvertently get two ballots. For instance, we set up a procedure whereby every member is entitled to request one replacement ballot. So you might get the one we mail you, and then you might think, I'll ask for another one and see if I can get it. So that's the outgoing process. And we recognize we can't control everything about the outgoing process. So our control is on the incoming process, where each member is entitled to request an additional ballot in case the dog eats it or they lose it or whatever happens. But on the return, you're only allowed to cast one ballot. And we actually physically stamp a roster. We used to stamp a roster. I confess, they might today, you know, make an electronic mark. We have a CPA firm that conducts this. But basically, you know, it comes in. We'd stamp the roster by your member number in your name. And having stamped it, and the stamp says, you know, voted or mail vote, if you send in a second one, we look at the book and say, he's already voted and your other one doesn't get counted. So it's the back-end controls that we have. So I would, again, I can't tell you exactly how it will work because we haven't engaged in it, but I would imagine we would certainly have the same control at the back end rather than the trying to control the outgoing. Because, again, people will be, this is an optional method. You always have the opportunity to vote in person. Mm-hmm. And we have many members who we mail ballot to. Most of our members cast their ballots by mail. 99% of our ballots are cast by mail. Fewer than 100 out of roughly 14,000 are cast in person. But everyone has that right. It's just less convenient for people to come to the meeting. So we have to have procedures for what if somebody mails in a ballot and then shows up at the meeting and wants to vote in person. We have the same concern, and we use the record of the mail voting to say, well, welcome to the meeting, but you're not going to get a ballot tonight. Just as we have a procedure that for people who mail in their ballot but forget to sign the envelope, and they think they have voted, and they show up at the meeting, and we say, here's your ballot, and they say, well, you shouldn't give me a ballot, I've already voted, and we say, well, we say politely, apparently not successfully, because you haven't yet been recorded as having voted. So we have all of those things built into our procedures today. The goal is to be fair. Every member is entitled to a vote, but every member is only entitled to one vote. And so the procedures we have today have tried to think through all of those what-ifs and, again, apply the controls at the back end, not the front end.
Follow up.
What action would you take if the mail-in ballot was for candidate A, the electronic ballot was for candidate B, and the in-person ballot was even different or could be for one of those two? If they're all the same, do you just take one vote and disregard the other ones? Well, and I would assume so. But what if they're different? Do you launch an investigation into fraud?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, we only let people vote once. But it is true that sometimes people may cast two ballots. And that most often happens in this way. The machine makes some, you know, jam or something and inadvertently stuffs two ballots into one packet. You know, it happens every year, but it only happens a half a dozen times every year out of 70,000 outgoing packets. So there are the occasional time when our election committee will be there on the day the ballots are open and counted, and the CPA will come over and say, here is an envelope that contained two ballots. Which one do you want to accept? And the election committee members will then look at the two ballots and they will make a judgment call. And one of those will be selected. And one of those, and only one, will be counted. Now, you would think if a person's mailing in two ballots, they would be identical. And most of the time they are. But every now and then, there is some odd peculiarity where, for whatever reason, a person may have marked two ballots differently. Again, this is very rare, once or twice in my 27 years has this situation occurred. But that's a case where our member volunteer election committee that has the responsibility for overseeing the mechanics of the election looks at what's presented by the CPA firm and renders a decision. The committee makes its own sort of procedures for how it makes a decision, but they make one. And at the end of that decision, either one of those two ballots is counted or potentially neither if they can't deconflict it. But really, that's a committee decision. The procedures state basically that in these situations, the committee will make a decision. The committee members determine sort of in advance how do they want to handle those situations, but it's not one of the written down procedures other than the committee has that responsibility.
Mr. Chair, final question.
Final question.
It's one ballot per household, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, it's one ballot per member. Now, if in the case of a residential situation, a single person can have a membership, a married couple can have a membership, a cohabitating couple will have one membership in one of those two people's names. So it's one vote per member, and then, of course, for our commercial customers, Safeway, for instance, may have 20 locations where we provide service. They'll have one member number.
Yeah, and here's the question. My wife gets the ballot, votes for Proposition 1, and I go, I'm getting the electronic ballot, and I'm going to nullify your vote with voting for against Proposition 1. Both of us are legitimate. What do you do?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, our procedures lay out the case for receiving multiple ballots. And sometimes, again, this is a decision by the election committee. For many years, the election committee had a procedure that said, if we get two ballots, the first one in counts. And I think in some more recent years, maybe they changed that to say, if we get two ballots, the last one in counts. That is a committee decision. The procedures are developed to implement the wishes of the committee, and different committees have had different philosophies on this. Some say, well, we don't want to have somebody run a last-minute big, you know, ad campaign and try and, you know, stir things up. If you've already voted, you've sent it in. And other people on committees in other years say, well, you know, perhaps a person has thought through the issue, gotten some new information, so the last one on account. I don't particularly care which they do, as long as, again, the goal is to have an election that survives any challenge. And that boils down to one member, one vote. So if we receive multiples, only one will be counted. Whether it's the first or the last will depend upon the wishes of the election committee.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Seaton to the committee. We have Representative Gernberg and Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three lines of questioning through the chair, if I may. First, the sponsor statement or somebody said, yeah, I guess in the sponsor statement, last paragraph, MTA, Matanuska Telephone Associations have voted to allow a new bylaw allowing electronic transmission voting. And then the letter from MTA, Mr. Greg Berberich, says, in the balloting process, we explained that before implementation could take place, the Alaska legislature would need to amend state cooperative law to allow for electronic voting. I understand from that, Mr. Steyer, that nobody has as yet started this.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, my understanding is that correct. No co-op in Alaska is currently doing electronic voting, although MTA and Chugach members have both voted to change their organization's bylaws to permit it if state statute is changed.
Second question. Looking at the amendment that's in the CS, and that's in the Senate CS also, except that electronic transmission may not be the only allowed option for voting, page 1, lines 9 to 10. In view of your testimony that you already have two methods of voting, by mail and in person, The thing that I'm concerned about is, at least under the wording of this, the two methods that could be allowed are in-person and electronic. That would effectively nullify the intent of this, which is to allow a method that people do really use to be the alternative for electronic voting. I would be prepared to offer an amendment that would cure that problem, and I'm not sure how we would do it, but one thing could say, at least one of the other options must be by mail. So you couldn't cut out the in-mail and basically cut out most of these people. And I have a number of people in my district, and it's the same as Senator Wilkowski's district in Mountain View, that don't have computers. And that would essentially thwart the intent of the CS amendment. How would you feel about an amendment to the CS that would add at the end, conceptually, one of which must be by mail?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, on if all we wanted to do was try and get this bill passed this year, just to pass this bill, perhaps. But here is my concern. What's the advantage of electronic transmission? Well, it offers different advantages, I suppose, convenience to some and others. One of the advantages long term is probably money savings. And where do the money savings come from? Well, the money savings come from people who say, you know what, don't send me a packet, just let me vote electronically. Now, how do we get from here to there? I can't quite tell you. In my mind, one way might be we do this for a few years where we mail you something and you can mail it in, or you could do this electronic thing. And then maybe at some point in time we say, you know what, we're not going to mail you something if you tell us not to. And then maybe we evolve to something else. I can't tell you. I would hate to, for the sake of today, say, well, sure, let's do an amendment like that. If it precluded at some point us cutting down on the pieces of mail we send out, if that's in keeping with member wishes and if that's actually a good thing to do. And here's my corollary for you. The Alaska Permanent Fund. With the Permanent Fund, we all used to be mailed this packet. And in the packet, over time, you know, initially we were mailed this packet. And then later we were mailed this packet, and in the packet it said, you know, or I guess an alternative to being mailed the packet was, you can go online and get this information and file your thing online rather than returning this paper. And lo and behold, now after a number of years, we've come to 2010, and this year the Permanent Fund Dividend folks say to us, go online and do your work. If you want a packet, request one and we'll mail it to you. So there is this evolution of this technological improvement. And I'm, without having more time to think about it, the amendment you suggest, if we always have to mail everybody a packet, I would be concerned that that takes us in a direction that we maybe don't want to build into statute. But the option, I think, of requesting something by mail, at least for Chugach, will probably always be there. So that would be my concern. I don't see that we ever would put ourselves in a position of not accommodating people that don't have computers and who can't physically get to a meeting. Mm-hmm. Back to an earlier statement of mine, our goal every year is to have an election that can withstand a challenge. Mm-hmm. Every member is entitled to a vote. If we set up a procedure that somehow disenfranchises some members and prevents them from voting, I'm pretty sure we'll get challenged right away, and I'm pretty sure we'd have a tough time winning that in that case. So it's not that we would want to get away from mail voting if that's the way that's most convenient and frankly doable for many of our members. So but again, I can only speak for Chugach, and I can only sort of foretell a future. I can't cement us to it, but at the end of the day, the goal here is to have an additional option that we test for a number of years before we move to make any significant changes.
May I follow up, please?
One follow-up.
Mr. Steyer, it certainly wouldn't be my intention to preclude you from going through the evolution you're talking about. but I am concerned about that issue. And I'm also concerned about the issue that Representatives Johnson and Representative Gatto have raised about different kinds of, as Representative Gatto said, at least scams, and as Representative Johnson has said, security issues. And we have a fiscal note from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, and we have Mr. Rich Gazaway on the phone from that commission, and I will ask him the same question with the permission of the chair. And I'm reading from page 2 of the fiscal note. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska has limited jurisdiction that includes regulating the rates and services of non-exempt electric telephone cooperatives, and then there's a citation. With the exception of deregulation elections governed by a statute, RCA jurisdiction does not extend to membership voting procedures. Members of electric and telephone cooperatives seeking to enforce the electronic voting procedures proposed by this legislation would need to pursue judicial recourse rather than RCA intervention. I see we have Mr. Will over here from the court system, but that's a pretty cumbersome method, and it's not an organization. The court system is not as familiar with co-ops and the way these organizations operate as the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And I would be prepared, instead of what I had earlier discussed, maybe a provision that would put the jurisdiction over this issue in the RCA. And that way they could deal with the evolution in case the cooperatives wish to eliminate the use of mail, and could deal with security issues and scam issues and take it out of the court system, but give them additional jurisdiction. How would the co-ops feel about that?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, again, speaking only for Chugach. This statement in the fiscal note doesn't pertain simply to electronic voting. It does specifically in regard to what's before you today. But the fact of the matter is the RCA today does not regulate cooperative elections. The RCA doesn't have jurisdiction over our elections today. We're a private organization, member owned organization. If a member has a, or some other party was standing, has a problem with an election today or for the past 44 years, they take it to the court system now. So this is a statement of the way things are now for all our elections, that the RCA doesn't have jurisdiction. So your suggestion would be a pretty dramatic departure from that, and one that we would need more deliberation on, I'd have to say.
Thank you.
What's the typical turnout, as it is now, for one of your elections?
I looked, Chair, I looked at our last three elections and averaged it up. And for our last three elections, about 21% of our members voted, which equates to roughly about 14,000 ballots cast. You know, 1 year more, 1 year less, but I just took the last 3 years, added it up, and divided by three, and that's what we get. And frankly, for a co-op election, that's pretty good. Many co-ops or member-owned organizations, credit unions, for instance, get much lower turnout, single digits. For better or worse, the Chugach elections get a lot of attention and a lot of participation. And you might wonder, why are we even interested in this? Well, my board of directors is interested in this sort of for a couple reasons. They'd like to see more people vote in our election, and they think that this might be a way to encourage more member participation. They're hopeful that, in particular, more younger members might vote with electronic technology available. And then, as I say, we're all looking forward, and again, with reference to the permanent fund dividend application process, we're thinking, you know, the day might come when we could evolve to a system where the use of electronic transmission in voting provides a savings, just as the use of electronic transactions in business in other ways in our business have saved us money over the years. So those are probably the big three. And I would note that when I've these two organizations I spoke with in the lower 48 that do this, I asked them basically three questions. Do you have more members voting? Do you have younger members voting? And have you had any problems with security? I thought there were three good questions. I got two not very good answers in regard to the first one, which is, no, we've seen no real increase in voting, and we've never done any surveying or any other data collection to know if we have more members who are younger that participate. They did both say to me, we've had no problems with security.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if, and many businesses nowadays allow their customers to pay their bills online and enable them to do that, they have to set up, get a username, password, customer number, that type of a thing. And so if your organization had already had that set up, it wouldn't be too big of a stretch to allow those people to start voting, you know, electronically. And so I don't know if Chugach Electric has online paying available. I would imagine they probably do. And so I could see where that would obviously would save from having to mail out statements and therefore would save from having to mail out ballots. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons that this is coming forward besides the participation.
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, you are correct. We do currently offer ways where people can pay their bill online and do other business transactions with us online. And we have a number of members who have said to us, don't even send me something on paper. Just let me do it all electronically. And, you know, it's an evolution in business practice. And I will say to the question of security, on day one of us making that offering, we had already gone through that same drill that's been suggested here, where we've thought through how is someone likely to try and scam us electrically in terms of these financial transactions that take place online. And we got to a place where we were comfortable offering an online business transaction, bill payment and bill rendering service. And banks were way ahead of us getting there. And you're right. Over time then, as people said to us, don't mail me something, there was a savings from that. And I think many of those lessons will translate to electronic voting. And we're not the first state in the union to have, you know, gone down this path, and certainly not the first co-op in the nation to have done this. And again, I guess I go back to Chugach shouldn't offer this if Chugach can't be secure or be assured that it can offer a secure election option. So.
I'd like to, before you continue, I'd like to recognize Representative Peggy Wilson joined us some time ago, and I neglected to make a note of that. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would think that this electronic voting would be even more convenient in the rural parts of Alaska, where the smaller co-ops members may be spread out over a fairly large geographic area, and especially now that we're getting broadband and to areas that previously didn't have it. So I actually think this is probably the something we're going to see a lot more in the future for not only co-ops, for lots of other organizations that have elections of boards and types of things. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Gazaway from RCAIC, you are online available for questions. Do you have any comments? Anybody would like to ask anything of Mr. Gazaway?
No, Mr. Chairman, we're available to answer questions on the bill, and I think Mr. Spire earlier characterized the jurisdiction of the agency with regard to those elections.
Yes, and please identify yourself for the record.
Rich Gazaway with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Gazaway? If not, anybody else online that would like to testify? Anybody else in the audience who would like to testify? Okay. If not, I'll close public testimony and get some questions or comments from the committee. Vice Chair Seaton.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering on the issue of kind of voter fraud and those kind of things, if the penalty for voter fraud, committing voter fraud in a cooperative election would be similar to, you know, felony for voter fraud in other elections. I wonder if the Department of Law could let us know.
There's supplemental Department of Law here for another bill, I believe, but did anybody out there from the Department of Law give us a clue on that? When you all jump up at one time, it's difficult.
We have Mike Ford.
Know which one to choose.
Mike Ford, the legislative liaison, is here.
Yeah, I know he is. That's why I said that. Mr. Ford, do you have any insight on that that you could share with us? Please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ford. I am legislative liaison for the Department of Law. I am not here to testify on this bill. However, I'd be glad to get back to you with an answer to that question.
Okay. And that's fine. Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just would like to find out what that would be in a cooperative, you know, in a fraud in a cooperative voting election versus a state or municipal election. And
does anybody know if this subject came up in the other house, the other end of the hall? Would that make you reluctant to move the bill, that one question?
This goes to another committee?
This is it.
It's
been through Committee on Regional Affairs.
It's something of interest to me, Mr. Chairman, but I think that probably probably it wouldn't make me.
Thank you. Representative Wilson and then Peterson.
I don't want to hold it up either. However, I think it is something that we need to know because is there anything in here that does have a penalty if you do some kind of fraud?
I don't know. Answer that. Thank you, Mr. Ford. See what happens when you come in early?
That's Phil.
That'll teach you.
Are you aware
of
anything?
No.
This is our first hearing.
Yes. There's a companion bill in the Senate. Mr. Manley and then Mr. Steyer.
Go ahead.
Representative Wilson through the chair. Co-ops are member-owned private organizations. I am unaware of criminal penalties for fraud in a co-op election. Not to say they're not there, I'm just unaware of them. I'm also unaware of what the penalty is for a, you know, municipal or state election instance of fraud. So I guess I'm not the person to answer the question either.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
I really think it's something that the co-ops need to think about. What are they going to do if there's somebody out there that's going to be, if they would sway as far as who's elected the seat. So what have you decided you would do if you found someone that did do something that was against your bylaws?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, Chugach was incorporated in March of 1948. So my earlier reference was probably wrong, as they note, don't do math in public. We have had the potential for fraud in our elections, no doubt, since 1948. I can only speak for the last 24 years when I've been personally involved in our election process. Every year, there is the prospect for that. So whatever avenues are there currently will remain there if electronic transmission is adopted. So what's before you today is not a bill to allow voting in co-op elections. It's merely a bill to allow another option for voting in co-op elections. It does cause us all to stop and think, well, how might someone, as was noted earlier, I believe, before you arrived, how might somebody scam you electronically? I'm sure there are people out there who will think about how might they try and make mischief in that way. Just as there are people who, for the last 53 years, have thought about how might I scam Chugach in a paper election, or previous to that, in an in-person voting election. So every year, I'm sure there are people out to make mischief, and every year we try and have procedures that are tight and preclude it. But I will just say that in my time supervising the Chugach election, we've not yet had a case of fraud that has resulted in us being able to point to that individual attempted fraud in our election. So I have no example to cite for you how we deal with that, other than we do set up procedures to try and prevent that from happening.
Okay, one last follow-up.
Please, follow-up.
I think it probably, because we are moving into a kind of a new world, and we're starting to do things different, and more things we're doing on the internet, I think it probably behooves your organization to really sit down and think about, okay, we're going to do this. This opens up a whole new era. Just on the news this morning, I heard that the person that got into Sarah Palin's BlackBerry is now going to go to trial. And that was just a kid, a college kid. Okay, so I'm saying that the possibilities, people are so more into that type of thing now than ever before, and I just think it'd be wise for you to think about that and to prepare for it ahead of time rather than have to respond to it later on.
I think that might be good, but again, as Mr. Steyer stated, if somebody scams the system now with the current system, there's also no clear avenue of penalties, as I understand it. So this wouldn't change at all. The issue is there, whether we pass this bill or do not pass this bill. As I understand it, you know, really nothing changes. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it was of interest to me because of the newer technology. I realize it's the same as the current voting procedures. I think that if it is a criminal penalty, I think that also elevates the alleviates the chance of people wishy-washy or on a lark to go in and do these. But if there is that, it's going to be challenged. It's going to go to court, and that's going to be the effect. So I think that the cooperatives are going to be very stringent on looking after their systems to make sure that they set them up right. Otherwise, they're going to lose the ability to have their election valid. So I'm not on this point. I would like to find out, not only for ourselves but for the co-ops, but I'm comfortable enough with the courts being there as the remedy for voter fraud.
But I think it might be something to look at over the interim, and perhaps for those of us who are here in January may want to consider something like this for co-ops and other groups. Representative Johnson, let me get order here. Representative Johnson and Representative Peterson. And
I just, he was after
you're just
me.
Pointing.
That I'm third in line.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Grunberg. Okay, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comments are similar to what Representative Seaton was. I assure you 5 years ago, identity theft was probably not an issue. Electronic voting certainly wasn't an issue. And as these things change, it might be wise of us to look at it. But what I do want to say is it's not up to the co-op to determine if it's criminal for their elections to be to have fraud in their election. That's up to us. That's something that I agree with you that we need to look at. If we find out that's not wrong, that may be the first piece of legislation. What's at stake 45 years ago as compared to what's at stake today in a Chugach election is miles apart. The difference in the effect on the membership, depending on a voter swing of boards of directors, of disposition of assets, everything is just magnified, and it will continue to be as these co-ops become more valuable or less valuable. It's a tough business, and the values have gone up exponentially, as well as the debt service and the overhead. And so what's at stake in these is much larger now than it's ever been before.
I agree.
The opportunity for fraud that may not have existed in the past, or to the desire to defraud because of the value of what's at stake, I think has also gone up. Laws serve two purposes. One, they serve one for to clearly identify what we can and can't do, but in some cases they serve as deterrents.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that if we can have something in law on fraud that would protect, at least cause someone to think that, you know, I get a slap on the wrist if I do this, there's a lot at stake, it's worth taking that risk. If there's a lot at stake and the penalty is significant enough, they're less likely to take that opportunity. So laws serve two purposes, to not only penalize but to deter. So I would think that it would be wise for the legislature to look at the deterrent aspect of criminalizing fraud in these kind of elections as well, if it doesn't already exist. And it may. I'm kind of like Representative Seaton, I don't know. But I don't think this is the issue of this bill. I think this, what we're talking about here, is just another opportunity, another method of voting. And those other issues are going to be there whether this bill passes or not. It may be something we look at. So I'm encouraging the passing of this bill with a very close eye on strengthening, if it's not already strong, the fraud legislation. But I don't think now is the time to be particularly looking at that. I tend to agree with Representative Seaton.
Great. Representative Peterson, and then Grunberg, and I'm going to ask for a motion to move the bill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Steyer had mentioned during his testimony that it was, you know, he compared this to the way that the permanent fund dividend application has progressed and changed over the years. And I know to file for a permanent fund dividend, you need to be able to send an electronic signature, and there's a procedure that has been set up to do that. And I'm sure that the company that they may contract to handle these elections will have a similar procedure set up that will make it very, very difficult for someone to commit fraud. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it would be very, very difficult, I would imagine.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The staff is handing out a couple of sheets here. There should be two sheets, yeah, that deal with, it's from the election code, actually, AS 15.56.040, voter misconduct in the first degree, and AS 15.56.050, voter misconduct in the second degree. And these deal with attempts to vote in the name of another, or vote several times, or misregister. And they apply to governmental elections. They don't apply either to co-ops or to corporate elections. And I looked in the chapter dealing with co-ops, AS, I think it's 1025, and also the provisions in the corporate code in 1006, and there's nothing on either of those dealing with these issues. In fact, there are no criminal penalties for anything in either of those provisions. And I think that that what the chair said is a good idea, but it's not part of this bill, and it may be the tail wagging the dog here.
It's not part of this bill, so I'll entertain a motion for this bill.
Well,
Representative Seaton.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 336, State Affairs, Version R, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. Without objection, this bill passes from committee. Thank you, everybody, for coming in to testify. And we will look at these other issues, I think, during the interim. That's another subject for another bill, perhaps. Okay. By doing at ease, I think I did.
No, you didn't.
Okay, at ease while we do. Considering HB 400, the title of which is an act relating to emergency compensation and the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And it is a House State Affairs Committee bill. And please identify yourself and introduce the bill to us.
Okay, my name is Nancy Manley. I'm a staff to Representative Bob Lynn. And House Bill 400 proposes to increase the limit that victims of violent crimes can receive an emergency compensation from $1,500 to $300. The limit has not been increased since 1975 and can only be awarded to relocation, verifiable lost wages, and counseling for families and victims whose safety and well-being are at risk. The main reason for this increase is that the cost for these emergency expenses have increased substantially over the years, and $1,500 is unable to cover deposit, and first and last month's rent, especially when a family or dependents are involved. Emergency awards are necessary because the board only meets about 5 times per year, and it can be 10 or 11 weeks before a claim is considered. The Victim Compensation Fund receives approximately 70% of its appropriations from the state in the form of felons withheld permanent fund dividends and 30% from federal grants. This money does not lapse, only once placed in the fund. Emergency compensation is deducted from the final amount given to the victim, and any excess award must be repaid to the fund. The bill does not increase the overall cap of $40,000 that can be awarded to a victim, and there is zero fiscal impact on the state. Please support House Bill 40.
400.
400.
Yeah, I may not support House Bill 40. Don't even know what it is. Okay. Any comments, sir? Introduce yourself.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Grier Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas.
And he has a companion bill in the other house?
Yes, sir. Senate Bill 266 in the other body. Okay. As Chairman Lynn's aide stated, this fund was established in 1972. At that time, the emergency compensation limit was set at $500. 3 years later, in 1975, that limit was increased to $1,500. Calculated for inflation today, that same $1,500 would have the purchasing power of approximately $6,000. The Violent Crimes Compensation Board came to the $3,500 proposed in House Bill 400 based on the average rental cost, an average of approximately $1,200 to $1,500 per month, doubled for first and last month's rent with a deposit, was sort of the rule of thumb they used. As Chairman Lynn's aide stated again, emergency compensation can only be given out for three reasons: relocation-associated costs, counseling, and to cover verifiable lost wages. This money, though, is not given out freely. Victims have to show a plan for relocation and give a reason for it. Money for counseling is either paid directly to the provider or for out-of-pocket expenses. And lost wages must be verified by either 3 years worth of tax returns for those that are self-employed, pay stubs from the employer, and at that point, it's also only awarded at 80% of the full value to account for taxes that would be removed. Claims to the board have increased steadily since 1972, and in fiscal year 2009, the board paid out $25,547 for 22 emergency claims, 12 of those to the $1,500 limit. And so far this year, in fiscal year 2010, year-to-date, 24 cases have been emergency cases have been awarded for a total of $29,699. I also urge you to support the passage of House Bill 400 and help the Violent Crimes Compensation Board aid the victims of crimes across Alaska. Thank you very much, and I'm available for questions.
Right. Any questions for this gentleman? Thank you very much. Please remain there. Did you have some comments to make?
For the record, my name's Kate Hudson. I'm the administrator of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And I mean, one of the things I wanted to just add was to put this into context. In fiscal year 2009, the board awarded 478 claims total. 22 of those were by emergency awards. So it's not by any means that we're paying out emergency awards to everybody who asks. They have to be deserving cases. I make the initial review to determine eligibility. I would then submit those cases that I think need an emergency award to the board, and they then determine whether or not they should be awarded emergency awards. But the 1,500 limit, particularly, this is really affecting people who need to be relocated, because the cost of rents today, 1,500 does not go very far for a family with two or three dependents, and trying to move to a safe place, pay a deposit, pay the rent, get settled in. $1,500 is just a drop in the ocean, really, and that's why we're asking for the increase. And I'm available to answer questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you go back over the process? I thought I heard you say that you review it and then take it to the board, and then the board decides?
That's through the chair, Representative Johnson. That's correct. I review the claims to make sure that the basic eligibility requirements have been met, which means that we have evidence from the police that shows that there is sufficient evidence for compensable crime.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And did I hear earlier that the board met five times a year?
That's what I was, yeah.
To the chair, yes, Representative Johnson. The way the board determines emergency awards is that I send a précis of the facts to them, and they will consider those and respond to me via telephone or email.
Okay, follow up.
So the whole board has to do this by proxy, or do you have the chairman of the board can authorize it for approval later? Are we still talking about five times a year that? It doesn't accomplish the goal if someone can't get a check fairly quickly. So kind of work with me through the process of how I'm a victim. I need the money. I take it to you. I qualify. You go to the board, and they have to meet to do this? Or is there some process that really gets it to me quickly?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, what happens is that two out of the three board members have to respond to me via telephone or email to say, yes, this can be approved for an emergency award. I can then go ahead and get the check processed for them. At the next board meeting, that claim will be taken to the board for ratification and, if applicable, further award.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's
so from the time you put in the request, how long would it take, on the average, for the victim to have the money in hand, whatever the money is?
Mr. Chairman, the response from the board generally comes within 24 hours, sometimes a little longer, depending on their availability, their schedule. And then it's the question of how quickly the check can be processed through our internal accounting procedures in the Department of Administration. That generally takes 5 to 7 working days.
Okay. So within a week, the odds are they're going to have the money in hand. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. No effect on my approach to the bill. I just wondered, do you ever get scammed, duped, make an award, and then say, how do we get the money back? Does that ever happen?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that is what we seek to avoid. And one of the inbuilt mechanisms we have to avoid that is that as part of the application form, the claimants have to sign an acknowledgement that they will be required to repay any money that is subsequently, if they receive money from another source, for example, if they're asking for medical expenses and it turns out their health insurance will cover it, for example. So that should not happen. The second inbuilt thing is that, of course, we are only going to award emergency awards for people who it looks pretty clear cut that they are eligible. So I'm not going to say that it never, ever happens that somebody who really isn't deserving gets an award, but I think the inbuilt mechanisms that we have should make that extremely unlikely.
Reverend Gatto?
Follow up, please. And so people who are deserving are easy. They're broke. They've been a victim of a violent crime, et cetera. But what about people who have a decent income but really had a knockdown, drag-out fight and they're scared for their life? They don't qualify for an award because they have some money in the bank?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, the board has the statute sets out the situations in which the board can make awards. So, and federal statute also lays down that the board is a payer of last resort. So that if there are other sources that can pay for medical expenses, then that has to. Similarly, with other federal programs, Medicaid, Indian Health Services. Also, the board cannot make an award for pain and suffering. That is not within its power to do so.
Representative Gatto?
Last question. Representative Grunberg probably reminded that, and I think my very first year here, we worked together to add victims of arson as a violent crime that was added to the thing. But our concern back then is the same concern I'm thinking about now. Do you have enough money or, because we're reluctant to add one more category, but the board decided it was right. You run out of money? I mean, you rely on PFDs from felons and things like that?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, we have not, to my knowledge, run out of money. We come pretty close some years, but no, we have had sufficient money. And the other issue to bear in mind is that as state funding or state expenditure on awards to victims increases, so too does the federal grant, because the way the federal grant is calculated is that we receive 60 cents for every dollar we spend in state money. So as state expenditure increases, so do our federal receipts.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are in the legislature in the state of Alaska sort of concentrating our efforts in stopping domestic violence this year. It's a priority. And my question is do you have a lot of these victims that are contacting you? Is it because there's been a scene of domestic violence or violence within the home? Is that a major cause in these situations?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, yes, domestic violence and sexual assault is unfortunately a large proportion of the claims we get. I'm not sure I have the figures to hand to say what the exact proportion was. It's less than 50%, I do know that. But in particular in the emergency award situations, it is very often the domestic violence and sexual assault victims specifically that we are looking at, because they are the ones who are needing to be relocated for their safety.
Thank you.
Follow up. And so you mentioned earlier that sometimes it takes, or average may take a week for a person to get a check. And if someone needs to be relocated that's been in a domestic violence situation, a week would seem like an extremely long period of time. Are you able in really extreme emergency situations to expedite that even quicker?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, I agree with you. And unfortunately, we are limited to some extent by how quickly the accounting staff can process checks. All we can do is ask that things can be expedited, but it's an internal accounting mechanism that we are limited by to some extent. And in extreme situations, there are, of course, domestic violence shelters that women have to turn to.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have Mr. Godfrey on the line. Would you like to testify? Please, are you there? And please identify yourself. Mr. Godfrey, are you there?
Yes, this is Jared Godfrey, Chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board.
Well, he's there.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Five by five. Please continue. Identify yourself again, please.
Jared Godfrey, Chair of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. And I don't want to be redundant, but I will just summarize that the reason the board had sought an increase in the emergency award goes back to the fact that when the board was created back in 72, the emergency award cap was $500, and then in 1975 it was raised to $1,500. It hasn't been raised since, and adjusted for inflation, that's well over $6,000 differential there on the buying power, or in often the case that we're concerned with, the ability to lease an apartment, get a plane ticket out of a bad situation, rent a U-Haul, etc. And we've dealt with this for a number of years, looking at the emergency awards come in, and typically to rise to the level of emergency award to get to the board in between our board meetings, it would have to be for lost wages, counseling, mental health counseling, or else relocation. It's going to have to be one of those three criterias in order to get to us, and we probably have anywhere between five emergency awards in between a board meeting, up to maybe 10. And typically they will come from a domestic violence situation, and often this has been an ongoing situation, but one of the requirements of a person when they apply for compensation is that they cooperate with law enforcement. And there's a kind of a moment of opportunity when they're willing to work with prosecution and authorities to get this person, you know, convicted, that we have to take advantage of that and get them out of that situation if they want out. And that part of that goes hand in hand with them cooperating with law enforcement, because if we don't get them out, they're going to end up often backtracking on their cooperation. But very often, abusive husband or living boyfriend will tell them, you know, when I make bond or I make bail, I will kill you. And if they believe it, that's, you know, that obviously is affecting their mental health and their physical safety. And so when they come to us, we do everything we can to get them out of that situation. Generally, there's a minor or multiple minor children involved. So for an emergency ward, $1,500 would get the adult, typically the female, out of that situation. And then in the aggregate, we also get to apply the children or child. And so then, you know, you could have $3,000 or $4,500 to relocate them in between our next board meeting, which works, you know, effectively. But of late, we've seen on occasion where it's just a female with no minor children to lean on for the their emergency awards to get her where she needs to go. And that's not going to, $1,500 isn't going to cover first and last month's rent, a security deposit, let alone a plane ticket out of, say, Nome to Fairbanks or Fairbanks to Juneau, to relocate where they have a plan and a support system, typically close friends or family. And, you know, time is of the essence. You know, we don't want any of these guys making good on their promise because we couldn't get them the award fast enough, or because the award was not sufficient to get them out of that situation in between our board meetings. So that's basically the process behind this. I would say our administrator spoke very well to the questions that were asked of her just now. I will say that funding, I remember Representative Gatto and Representative Gruenberg a number of years ago with the arson issue, and our concern was really, you know, in exhausting our funds, but by making arson explicitly available as a compensable crime in the statute, we basically made it, you know, something of consideration for physical harm that may come to a person from an arson, or perhaps someone's jumping out of a second or third story window because there's no way out and they suffer injuries and can't go to work. Those kind of things would be compensable. It's not the property damage that would be incurred. And as far as, has the board ever been a victim of fraudulent use in the past? I would say twice in our tenure, and we've created policies to keep that from happening. We realized after the fact that an award was not used in the manner that it should have been. And so that's why we need a bill in hand, or we pay directly to the provider, or we absolutely always verify lost income, talking with the employer. Nobody gets a blank check. As far as people that are destitute and people that are solvent that come to us, we're a payer of last resort, and that applies across the board. So if there's an alternate payer, or Alaska Native Medical Centers was a care provider or insurance, we're not covering that. But it wouldn't matter if you were the wealthiest CEO in Alaska or somebody living on the street. You're entitled equally. We do not have the means to explore anyone's solvency or insolvency. So that's not a consideration, other than the fact we are a payer of last resort, and that stands consistent. This is a very prudent measure in the board's mind to address those dire needs, as clearly I've heard representatives speaking about it. They certainly see the need to, time is of the essence, to get women and children out of these situations when it arises. So that's, I think, basically why we think it's so essential to get this bill passed through. And that's the extent of it. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you. A little off topic, I guess, but when you relocate somebody, I assume the place of relocation is confidential?
You know, we ask them to put together a plan. They have to have a place, Mr. Chair, where they wish to go, that they can't just say, hey, give me a plane ticket to Hawaii or Vegas. You know, it's not going to happen. They're going to have a support system or a plan, and we will help them. Our administrator and her staff will help them, you know, figure that out if need be. Obviously, it's confidential from our standpoint, but we can't control if she tells the abuser or ends up, you know, giving a phone number 2 or 3 weeks after, you know, this happens. And unfortunately, that is a cycle in domestic violence situations. And what we find, Mr. Chair, is that more often than not, when you get an abused person or a victim at the place where they're cooperating with law enforcement, it's kind of like striking while the iron is hot. It's a golden hour for us to, I don't want to use the word exploit, but to exploit the fact that she is angry enough to act out against him and let the law do its due diligence in prosecuting him with her cooperation. And we facilitate that by getting her away from him and creating separation and also keeping her location a mystery. So we absolutely have to take advantage of that when she feels most willing to cooperate with law enforcement, see to it that he's prosecuted, charged and prosecuted in as much as she can. And we will get her out of there as quick as possible. We tend to see that when they're at that point where they're willing to do that, there's not much turning back for them. It happens. I'm not going to say it doesn't. But when you get a victim at the point where they're willing to take that gigantic step and you help eliminate the roadblocks from that step, usually they're at a position of resolve where they're you know, basically all their feelings and thoughts on the situation have kind of galvanized to that point where they're not going back, and they will try to remain a mystery, their locations to the abuser.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Anybody? Thank you, sir. Anybody else online to testify? Anybody in the audience to testify? Representative Wilson.
I would like to ask him a question.
Yes. Are you still there, sir? Mr. Godfrey, you still there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, yeah. Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you very much. I'm looking at the chart that you've provided that for 2009, the violent crimes, the new claims received during the year, and I tried to kind of look at that myself, and of course most of them have come from Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Palmer, and Wasilla. That's where the majority have come from. However, can you, there are some areas on here that are very small but had a lot of violent crime, at least claims, and I'm just wondering, have you been able to look at an area when there's a lot that come from that area and be able to say, this may be the reason, or these are the circumstances, or, you know, have you been able to make some assumptions because of it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I could only do so empirically, and the board could only do so empirically. We haven't tasked our staff with doing an analysis on the data that we have available. That's not to say we wouldn't or couldn't. If that's something that you would like to see presented to you next year when we're down there, we certainly could do that. We note that with a number of places, and then we look to see what the type of crime it is that somebody's asking compensation for. So there are places that I think are underrepresented based on their population and based on the type of predominant work. I grew up as from third grade to my second year of college, commercial fishing out of Kodiak. You could call that a blue-collar town. And when fishermen are in town, fishermen tend to get rowdy. And even so, in my opinion, Kodiak, for its population, is underrepresented. Does that mean that the crimes aren't taking place and they're simply not getting reported to us? Don't know, but in my opinion, Kodiak, for years, my number of years on the board, is underrepresented for its population and the fact that you have a large fleet of fishermen, whereas we can look at Ketchikan and say that comparable community in a number of facets, and I could say that the type of crimes that we get from there and the volume, not to say that it's a lot, but the volume is higher than I would expect, looking at the rest of the state, comparable communities, and the types of crimes tend to be pretty severe physical assault and battery, or worse. But I can only say these things empirically, and you know, we'll discuss that as a board when we're sitting there and say, wow, another one of those types of claims from Bethel. You know, Bethel has a certain character of claims that we get, and again, probably disproportionately high. Sometimes it may be that the victims are learning about us more so in one area, where in a community of similar size with similar crimes, they're not, or they're just not applying. Hard to say, but we do note that. We do note communities that are probably underrepresented, which I wouldn't say is a bad thing for having victims of violent crimes submitting to us. It's a bad thing if they're victims and they're not submitting to us, but it's not a bad thing if they're not victims, obviously. We would love to go out of business and have no need to exist, for sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And one follow-up.
Yes.
You know, I know that you can't make any hard assumptions on this, but when we as legislators go on to other areas of this, you know, when we're doing budgets and whatnot, we try to think, well, what can we do as prevention? And it might be next year that you can say, well, we noted this in this area, and this could have been basically all from the same family, or it was definitely while under the influence of alcohol or drugs, or I mean, there's a lot of extenuating circumstances. I'm sure it'd be good for us to know.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that in fact is something that we had tasked the administrator with doing a couple of years ago. Administrator before Ms. Hudson was in place, because we do have a wealth of data when it comes to crime and violence and victimization that comes through our office in the form of claims and substantiation through police reports and court records. And we actually requested a couple years ago to compile any notation of alcohol involved, whether it be the victim or the offender, which usually both would be consuming alcohol if it was one or the other. It would usually be both if there's alcohol involved at all. And then same with drugs. So we could categorize and come up with a percentage of claims, you know, for that calendar year, or that fiscal year, I should say, that reflected which percentage were sex crimes, which percentage had alcohol involved, and which percentage had two other categories. And I'll be honest, we did it for our own sake, but didn't really have a depot to say, oh, here's some information in case you want to see it, other than in our annual report where we put some pie graphs and charts in there for a quick reference so legislators can look at it in 60 seconds, get a feel for what the board's doing in the last year of board activity, and then move to their other business. And perhaps that's something that we could look at doing again going into our next fiscal year and present that to you, because I do believe it's valuable data if somebody knows where to go with it and what to do with it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. No public testimony is closed. We go to the committee now for any comments. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, I just have one question. If someone is taken, they leave a violent situation and go to the wake shelter or one of those, are they compensated? Is that shelter eligible for compensation out of the violent the crimes, or is it strictly just for independent? So I'm wondering if there's an interagency. That's not they're not an agency, but I'm wondering if those shelters are compensated.
Through the chair, I will say that no, we do not compensate shelters. That's their mission. That's what they're set up for. The board has a mission, and so in essence, we don't see the purpose, nor do we know that we even have the authority to essentially rob Peter to pay Paul, so to speak. It would be shuffling money for the same cause. We are there and willing to assist a person who would end up in a shelter because they're a victim. If they come to us, and when they do, often we do get them out of the shelters, but we do not compensate a shelter for somebody staying there, just as surely as we will not compensate the Alaska Native Medical Center. for fulfilling its mission by providing health care to Alaska Natives, and as well as those Alaska Natives without insurance coverage. And that has been a point of contention with the Alaska Native Medical Center over the years, and that's that. That's the board. Board will not do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that was the right answer, in my opinion.
So good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll entertain a motion to move the bill.
I'll move the bill with individual recommendations.
The bill is moved by Representative Grinberg with individual recommendations. Do a fiscal note here.
Yeah.
The attached fiscal note. Without objection, the bill moves. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good program.
Thank you.
Mr. Seeker, will you come forward? We'll take Ed East to do the paperwork. HB 348, which is an act relating to membership on the State Personnel Board. And you don't have much time. I want to get this at least introduced, get the concept we have here, go as far as we can. And then I would hope, since it's unlikely to pass out on today's hearing, to move it out of committee on Tuesday. Please introduce yourself, Mr. Seeker.
Okay.
And introduce the bill.
My name is Mike Seeker. I'm staff representative Bob Lynn. And real quickly, HB 348 just simply increases the membership of the personnel board from 3 to 5 members, and modifies the selection process to help us create a layer of insulation between, while we feel not hampering the governor's powers to appoint the members of the personnel board. Real quickly, the bill, most of the substantial changes are in Section 1. It quickly says we're increasing membership from 3 to 5. Just real quickly on that, 3 members is not a lot on any kind of a board. And one person's not there, you got 2. So we think 5 is a better number. The governor's going to make the appointment from a list of at least 3 nominees selected by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, subject to the right of the governor to reject those lists. And we're looking at getting at least 1 member from the 2 parties that had the highest number of votes in the most recent gubernatorial election. And just real quickly, the intent behind these changes are to create a board that operates, or at least operates, with greater independence when addressing complaints against the governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, and performing its duties under the Executive Branch Ethics Act. Okay, and we think that a 5-member board it's less likely to be captured in terms of everyone being appointed by a sitting governor. It's less likely there'll be a membership with a single mind in any proceeding. And we think that by having the Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice appoint them through rejectable lists, we provide that insulation, like I said, while allowing the governor to retain the power to appoint. And the idea of the 2 different parties is to make sure that we have some diversity of opinion there. We also put in a section there, that's Section 1, basically. Section 2 is just a conforming change. Now that you have 5 members instead of 3, not more than 3 of them can be of the same party. Earlier, it was not more than 2 for 3 members. That's a new section, Section 3. That's what we call our conflict section. It's very similar to what you see on the Alaska Public Offices Commission members and with the Select Committee. In fact, those are much more restrictive. These are just the, you can't hold a campaign for elective office, you can't be an officer for a political party, political committee or group, or lobby, employer, or assist a lobbyist, okay? And then finally, again, Section 4 are conforming changes. Instead of 2 members now being a quorum, it's 3. Instead of 2 votes being an affirmative action, it's 3. And finally, that last section, the uncodified section of law, basically says the people that are currently on the board stay there until they're finished with their term. Within 60 days of the effective date of this, the Supreme Court Chief Justice submits a list of 6 names for the 2 additional people with staggered terms. Okay? And real quickly, if you look in your packet, there's a memo there from Alpheus Bullard, Ledge Legal. Anytime I think you have these kind of situations where you talk about modifying the selection process, it raises a constitutional question, the separation of powers. But when you read this opinion, I get the feeling that there's a little of this and a little of that. On the one hand, we have a strong governor On the other hand, the legislature has helped with boards and commissions before. On the one hand, the Department of Law has taken a very protective approach to the governor's selections. On the other hand, three Alaska Attorney General opinions or letters of advice have accepted that the legislature may prescribe these reasonable qualifications for governor's appointments to the boards and commissions. And I think he finishes by saying is he can't say which way it'll go. I just want to add one last thing, if we're in a rush. When you go to the State of Alaska website, right under the director's office, the State of Alaska Personnel System, they describe the personnel board this way. It says, the personnel board, also created by the Personnel Act, is an independent agency composed of membership appointed by the governor. What this bill does is really try to fine-tune that balance. Some people think it might be a half a bubble off. This puts a level to it and creates the balance that I think is the intent of this posted right on their site. And this will help not only the board, and the board needs help. They take a lot of heat for a lot of their decisions. Some of it's unfair and justified. It will help the filer of a complaint feeling there's a more deliberate body. It helps the public in their perception of this. And when you look at other similar agencies, like the Alaska Public Offices Commission, you've got a five-member board there. I was really surprised to find out that four of those members, two of them are recommended to the governor from the central committee of the two political parties that have the most.
Can you repeat that, please?
Four of the members of the Alaska Public Offices Commission, two of them come from recommendations of the central party of the political central committee of the political party that had the highest votes in the latest election, and the one with the second highest. And the fifth member is recommended then by the four members with the right of the governor to reject the fifth member. But it doesn't say anything about that for the original four. We have a rejectable list. I just wanted to point that out.
That's very interesting.
I have lots of other information, but I know you don't have a lot of time, on the history of the select committee and the involvement of the judicial selection in the Legislative Ethics Committee, but I'll leave it there.
You think the Chief Justice might trump the impartiality of people of the political party committees in the 40 districts? You don't have to answer the question. Okay. Representative Seaton, and then Representative Peterson.
Thank you. On page 2, line 15, and on new section, this adding this new section on line 15 where it says on page 2 mm-hmm. line 15 of the prohibited while you're a member of the personnel board to lobby, employ, or assist a lobbyist. By assist a lobbyist, you mean for compensation? I'm afraid that assist a lobbyist
yeah.
could be construed in a number of different ways, especially if you have a spouse that's a lobbyist or something like that.
giving him a ride.
Okay. through the chair.
Providing the chair, a meal.
Providing him a meal, yeah. Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, this language is identical to the language that's listed on the Section 1513.020 Alaska Public Office Commission. If you go down to Section A5, they list as one of the prohibited behaviors, lobby, employ, or assist a lobbyist. It's word for word the same. And I guess that doesn't answer your question, but it's already in law for APOC.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say that I'd like the committee to look at that, because I think whether we have too broad a language or undetermined language in other law,
I think we need to check on that before the next the next committee meeting. Amendment may be in order.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at the fiscal note, and I see that it has a zero fiscal note, and I was wondering when they have their meetings, do these members, don't they travel? And so if you're adding two additional members, wouldn't that be an additional expense?
Through the chair, in looking at the number of meetings and stuff, when I was looking at the personnel board, I don't know how many meetings they have. It just says they establish their own rules of procedure. I know per diem is covered. That's a good question. That's something I'll have to look into as well.
Thank you, Mary. The one of the intents of this legislation, this is a committee bill, is to help erase the potential perception that we have the fox watching the chickens on a thing, which would be really unfair to the governor, you know, et cetera. And so we want to insulate, you know, help insulate at least the governor from these types of situations. I don't really think there's been a problem in the past, but there's always the perception out there. And in politics, you know, perception often becomes reality in the public mind. And so I want to apologize to the Department of Law today, who sat patiently through all of our wonderful deliberations on the preceding four bills. And so I'm going to bring this up as the first order of business in our next committee meeting. And I'll ask you for a quick recap, again, of what you just said at the meeting on Tuesday to bring us up to date. So we're going to hold HB 348 until our next State Affairs Committee meeting. We do not have the Tuesday schedule put together yet for the committee, except that I will attempt to put this bill back, HB 348, first in line on Tuesday. We do not have a meeting on Saturday. I must warn the committee that we are getting very, very close to having to have some Saturday sessions. So kind of as a warning, prepare perhaps for next Saturday, depending on what bills come in that have been assigned to the State Affairs Committee. So with that, I want to thank the committee for the good work today, and those in the audience who had the patience to remain through all this testimony, and we are adjourned.